Welcome to another episode of the CTO to CTO podcast. Zalando has been setting industry standards since its early days in 2008. A huge part of the success of this retail phenomenon is its primary focus on software development. Zalando's migration towards the microservices architecture is still a model case for many engineers. This week, Piotr speaks to Jan Hegewald, Zalando's Director of Engineering of the Product and Category Experience. From this episode, you will learn about the structure, processes, and the day-to-day challenges of the over 200 teams powering the biggest European fashion store. You will also hear Jan's thoughts on how to find the difficult balance between great architecture, clean code, and the need for speedy implementations. Tune in.
Zalando's migration towards microservices architecture is one of the first e-commerce cases so broadly discussed, I guess. Maybe the first one at such a scale. Actually, I was wondering how it works in the backstage. So what are the pros, cons, and the daily life of the team powering the biggest European fashion store? Well, I can't wait to ask all those questions to my guest, Jan Hegewald, Zalando's Director of Engineering of Product and Category Experience. Hi, Jan. Thanks for accepting my invitation.
Hi, Piotr. Thanks for having me.
That's awesome. Let's start with your experience, with your background. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. So from my professional background, I studied computer sciences in the beginning, and then I worked for around 10 years in the consulting business, developing custom software for big clients. So I went through all the phases of software development, from requirements engineering to design, implementation, testing, rollout, project management, and so on. And yeah, after that, I was switching to another company that was also a smaller consulting firm, and there I was heading my first team, so I had the first opportunity to gather experience in a leadership position. Mm-hmm. That was more about process, program, portfolio management, methodology, but also very technology focused. And at that time, that didn't really fit my personal life anymore, because I had a first child at that time already, and so I looked for something else, and then I figured out that a good opportunity would be in e-commerce. So I joined Idealo, which is a European price comparison platform. And I was head of technology there for the B2B business, so the integration of 100,000 of sellers with the price comparison platform. And yeah, I worked there for 4 years. And after that, which is now 3 years ago, I joined Zalando.
Awesome story. So you first started in a more engineering roles. Mm-hmm. Have you coded by yourself?
Yeah, for sure. I started with C++, and later on, of course, a lot of Java, C Sharp, and so on. And yeah.
Solid background. Then managerial skills, and then you finally landed at Zalando with e-commerce experience from the previous job. So sounds like perfect fit to the role. And your role is engineering director of product and category experience, right? So what does it exactly mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we've structured our teams in Zalando in different areas, and product and category experience is basically making sure that we serve the right product data to our customers and that they see right offers and so on. So I'm responsible for like three teams. The first one, which I also started being responsible for, is the product offer platform. This is Zalando's central platform, a backend platform that combines prices, stock levels, and product data into offers. Of course, what we also do there is like some business steering, like what is available where, and we also decide which one becomes the merchant of record if there are multiple offers by multiple merchants. And then we steer that to all the different what we call sales channels, that's the different markets and channels we're active in. So this is a really back-endish, high-load data processing platform. It's the first team. And then secondly, I'm responsible for the engineering of the product experience team. That's the name for the team that owns the product detail page. So the page that you see when you look at one specific product on the page. With everything, the images, the description, the reviews, and so on and so forth. And thirdly, I'm responsible for a team that's called category experience. With that team, we aim to average the experience when shopping on Zalando. Far, it had been very much tailored to fashion shopping, right? But for example, we also have beauty products. And if you're interested in beauty products, you have different questions as a customer, because then you're not necessarily only interested in sizes. But for example, it's more interesting if you look at, let's say, face creams or something like that. What's your skin type, for example?
Absolutely, yeah.
And we want to build specific user experiences tied to those problems. Another area of that is also elevating, for example, designer fashion items from normal fashion items to provide a really comfortable and unique experience for people shopping there.
Gotcha. So in other words, if I'm browsing the Zalando or entering the site from Google directly to product page or category pages, I'm interacting with the code deployed by one of your teams or even all of them, because the back and front end separation. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's fantastic. So you have a really huge impact on the whole Zalando experience.
Maybe. I mean, there's many other teams, right? It's just a small part. And to also put it into perspective, across Zalando, we have around 200 delivery teams. And the ones I mentioned now are roughly, let me quickly count, it's rather like 5 or 6 of them. So there are many more contributing to the whole experience.
Gotcha. So what's the size of a typical team, one of those three you have?
Five and a half. It depends, but I think we go with the usual rules, like something around maybe 5-7 or something. It also depends on how you count, right?
Gotcha.
For example, this product offer platform mainly consists of backend engineers solely, while the product experience team consists of some backend engineers, but then mainly front-end engineers, partly working on web, partly working then on apps also, so Android and iOS. And then there are designers and product managers, of course, in every case. And so it really depends on what we're doing and how you count these people in or not. So also, and let's talk about this category experience team that has been newly built. This consists today of around 18 people coming all together, right?
Okay, so three projects, but five different teams, right? Because I didn't get this right, and you corrected me. So that's the composition, right? And five teams.
The areas that I were referring to, I would rather count as departments. And within them, there are partly several teams.
Gotcha.
That's why I count it differently.
Awesome. So I'm going to have some questions on how those teams work, I mean the development process, but maybe first I ask you something probably you already answered many times. I mean, microservices and Zalando story. So if you can say a few words about the motivation and the process, where you been a part of this process, or was it already there when you joined the company?
Understood. When I joined the company 3 years ago, I mean, we were mainly already in a microservices architecture. However, I know the history, at least from people telling it. Nevertheless, I think even most companies which are sufficiently complex, even if they have moved into microservice architecture, still have some hidden monoliths, and so do we. So it's not fully done. I can also tell about the history maybe of how this went. This was definitely before my time, but when Zalando started, which has been more than 12 years ago now, it was, of course, built on running on a small system as a typical startup, right? It was running on a Magento e-commerce system. And obviously, it did quite well at that time. But at some point, it encountered some limits to be able to scale that. And then how it normally goes, also, Zalando built something by themselves in order to cater to the specific needs that they had in order to be able to differentiate themselves from competition. And they built their own monolith, as yeah. also so many do. And over the time, also you experience then with monoliths the limits to scaling these. And that was the time when they decided to go to microservice architecture. And yeah, I think we're very well in that regard set up. So we're really having a microservice oriented architecture. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to work with these 200 teams in parallel. But nevertheless, there are also some legacy components that
that's
we still
a good
need
point,
to become.
Because you meant scalability, but you really mean scalability in order to scaling the team and structures even more than the performance of the website, right? To scale up the teams working on the code with monolith is a nightmare.
Yeah. Actually, it's both, I would say. So the one thing, uh-huh. why or the one reason why you would like to have a microservice architecture is because it decouples the components and it allows teams to work independently, right? And so you can work on features in parallel that you're not able to work on in parallel if you are in a monolith architecture. So that's kind of the development scaling. And the other thing is also right that you mentioned, it's the performance scaling, because if you're running a monolith software, you can typically only scale the whole, right? So if you have a backlog in, let's say, I don't know, checkout, to make up an example, you have to scale the whole application and all the underlying hardware it's running on, if it's on-premise at these times, in order to scale just one part. And this gets much easier, of course, in the microservice architecture, because you can scale the parts hopefully independently from each other.
Yeah, you can still scale only those parts that are under pressure. It's much easier. But on the other hand, I guess managing the whole microservices architecture is more complex. But I have another question on that in a second. But first, let me just ask one more question about this migration process. Any insights how long it took to finalize this migration? Or maybe is it something which is still going on? I mean, because I guess it was iterative process, right?
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. I would also recommend always to do it in an iterative process. I can't say exactly because I was not at the company at that time. However, I would assume it took definitely quite some time to move the most part into a microservice based architecture, like a year or more, definitely. And you're right, it's not always in a way that you can say it's now completely done. We have some leftovers, but these are super minor, so it's not like there's much left. But there are still some leftovers, so it's hard to say. But if you ask for how to do it normally, I would always think that doing it in a kind of incremental approach is good. Because also, if you move from a monolithic architecture and working on that, switching to a microservice architecture, you have to learn and get used to it, because it also comes with some pitfalls that you should avoid. And if you do everything at once, it's quite risky, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, this touched the next question I prepared, because I wanted to ask you what works and what not in this architecture. You work also at smaller shops, dev shops, so you probably can somehow compare it to working with smaller teams, simpler architectures. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the main things that work well is what we discussed before. It's the scalability that you get from it, in both in terms of how much you can parallelize the work and increase your feature output velocity, let's say, and also how you can scale the performance of the system itself. Okay. When it comes to challenges, it's not just benefits, right? It comes with some challenges for sure. And where I see the most important challenges is in that you need some overarching governance. I mean, it sounds very anti-agile and so on. But let me give you some examples. For example, we did an internal investigation how many programming languages we use within Zalando, and the result was 43. Of course, you could argue that's one too much if it's 43 and not 42, but you could also argue that it's many too much. So, because why is it a problem? Yeah. I mean, we had some exotic languages and that teams wanted to work on and decided to use. And then the teams kind of dissolved and no one was able to pick up the work they had been doing before. That's a problem. Mm-hmm. And also what you want to achieve and challenge that we currently try to tackle is you want to be able in such a complex system to also not optimize only with on one team, but to do overarching bigger things. And for that, yep. you need to be able to work across multiple teams together. And if you yep. are so diverse in your technology, it becomes harder, right? And so this is definitely yeah. a challenge, especially at this time. We were, I think, also quite famous for this radical agility where teams had the autonomy to do yeah. kind of what they want. And this was, of course, a kind of misunderstanding. This was not intended, but this is where this stems from. And the second, and the second issue that I want to highlight under this umbrella of this governance that is needed. If you look into a microservice architecture, there is one paradigm that is you should decouple services, right? So they should yes. be independent from others. That's the main yes. principle. And for that, you also apply it to data. So it should be that no databases, for example, are shared. And we did the same. And also when I came in, I was responsible first only for this product of our platform, also with this narrower set of components than it comprises of today. And then other mm-hmm. components from other teams were later on handed over to us. And it turned out that today, if you look at this landscape, we have, for example, a data store that stores, in the end, the same information. It's all the offers, but yep. we have four of them. Because this was first That's part of another team, that was part of another yep. team. One is serving the data, one is processing the stuff. And the problem around that is that this, of course, not cost efficient because you really duplicate the data. And the volumes we are talking, this makes a difference in terms of costs. And so you need to be careful yep. of such effect. You need to take care of such effect. And what you need to do, despite you want these teams to operate independently, you need to take care of the big picture, like the overarching technology and architecture, to keep it efficient and efficient in terms of processing, but also efficient in terms of cost, for example. And so this is what yep. you need to take care of, especially if the architecture really grows.
So I guess that this is also a matter of scale. I mean, yeah. you said that you have about 200, like you said 200, right? Teams? Working. Man, 200 teams. it's really a lot. So I mean that at this scale, this is the price worth paying for this complexity. But, you know, on the smaller teams architecture, such a complexity could potentially not make sense.
Yeah.
Or maybe be too costly.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm wondering, like, you also said that 43 yeah. languages. So you are using this feature of microservices that the language is a secondary decision because everything lays on, service contracts to the max, I guess, which is interesting. But it also means that the team have pretty... high level of independence, right? They can choose whatever tech stack they virtually like.
It was like that in the past, which led to these 43 programming uh-huh. languages. As we figured out, this is not... That comes with some problems and challenges.
Yeah.
This is why we want to keep this flexibility and some independence to the teams. However, we also want to standardize a bit more. One measure yeah. that we introduced in order to do that is our tech radar, the Zalando tech radar. Mm-hmm. You can also publicly see it. It's available at opensource.zalando.com/tech-radar. And it's a classical tech radar like the one invented by ThoughtWorks. It comprises of frameworks, data management, technologies, languages, and infrastructure. And then it assesses these on a scale of adopt, trial, assess, and hold. And mm-hmm. what we do is we use this as a kind of guiding mechanism for teams to have a kind of assessment of or in standardization of technologies that are used so that not everything yeah. is tried out and everything can be found in production.
Gotcha. That makes perfect sense. So it's more like guidance than very rigid structure. So a lot of pragmatic approach.
Yeah.
makes perfect sense. You also just mentioned, and I would like to get a little bit deeper about the integration of features. I mean, everything is fairly easy. I guess it's fairly easy when you have features touching just the scope of your team or your neighbor teams. I mean, if you like to add feature just to the category page or product page or experiment with this, it's, you know, something you can deploy on yourself. It's fairly easy. But if you need to add some features that are touching, let's say, 10 different project teams, because it's something with, I don't know, maybe with pricing delivery, maybe you can give us some example of the most complex feature you you implemented that were touching everything. And the second question is how this process looked like of implementing and integrating this feature from business decision to deployment.
You mean these complex features which range across many teams?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm happy to
some extreme example.
Yeah. One example, a very recent one, even, is we have launched in autumn this year this pre-owned fashion. This means that you can today, you can also sell back your clothes that you have worn and that you don't like anymore, but that are in good condition. Yeah. Of course, you can sell them back to Zalando, and Zalando will also offer them to other customers. So it's a really good initiative to be more sustainable in terms of of the fashion industry.
Yeah.
And as you can imagine, this is super complex to implement because it ranges across everything, right? You have to consider logistics processes. It has to be considered in payments. It has to be considered in the on-site experience and so on. So this is really an example of how to, of the ability or the need for us to be able to execute initiatives of that complexity and, touching so many teams. Mm-hmm. And, your question was how do we make sure that this works in a coherent way, right?
How the process looked like from the decision that you need this feature up to deployment, like just to give us a brief, you know, overview, how you integrate, how you synchronize all those teams, how the process looked like.
Okay, understood. So when a decision is made that such an initiative is prioritized and we want to work on it, then it's also, that's super important. It's very transparent because we have an overarching, commonly shared prioritization list. And what we also have, we make sure on the execution level and also in the, before in the design and in the preparation of the initiative, that there's someone overarchingly architecting this. And this is happening on multiple levels. So, of course, there's someone responsible on the product management side for holistically driving this, then including all the contributing teams and aligning with them what their parts to the solution or their contributions to the solution need to look like. We do the same on the architectural level with some principal engineers, for example. One may be responsible for the overarching architecture, but then closely aligning with principal architects or senior engineers from the contributing teams. And we have a product development process that makes sure that we are always kind of in sync with that, or that nothing gets lost, because it has some guiding questions that we need to answer before we move on. So the first question is always when it's really in the discovery phase in the product development, we answer, is this a problem worth solving? So it guides to this prioritization decision. Yeah. Is it really the thing that we want to invest in now because it makes a big difference for the customers? And if this is answered, then it goes to the next phase, which is the design phase. And then that we design the user experience, the user journey, the UI, and also the architecture behind. So this is done there. And then there is another question that is, are we ready to build this? And only when this is answered, and this is really, we have looked and checked whether everything is considered, or the dependencies are checked, and so on and so forth, and there is a commitment from the teams that they can do it, and we also have some understanding of the timelines that they can contribute to that, then we start into the execution and do the delivery. And afterwards, there's even another question, and that is, are we ready to roll this out to customers? And only when this is checked and positively answered, we then launch such big things towards our customers. And if you're asking more on a technical question, on the technical side, of course, all the teams, as they're working independently, they deploy independent from each other. So normally we have something like it depends on what's really the change. But of course we need to have the data from the backend. So this is all rolled out already, presented to the front end, services and components, for example, but they only later on pick it up and we have some feature toggles or something that prevent this from being visible before everything is done.
Gotcha. Feature toggles. Because that was something I was wondering about, because they probably deploy the all dependencies at different pace because there are decoupled things.
Yeah, definitely.
So you need to somehow have this toggle that this feature is eventually and finally deployed everywhere, like every dependency was deployed, so switches on. Do you have something like a tool for managing those flags and dependencies, or is it something manually done?
No, I think it's a little bit different than you summarize it now. It's not like we have one global feature toggle for that feature, let's say this pre-owned fashion, but it's all the teams implemented by themselves, because often you don't need it everywhere, right? Because you want the data to be published up until the front end, but just without displaying them. And so you can allow that each individual team to do it as soon as they're ready to do it, because then they can also do, it's not end-to-end test because it's not totally end-to-end, but the part that you can cover through your testing gets bigger and bigger and the pipeline gets longer and longer. And so this is upon each team individually to decide that, and they maintain their feature targets. And then it's also the question of really managing this on the initiative level to make sure that this is done in a meaningful way. But also this allows this parallel approach where in the backend you can already test all the stuff while the front end is waiting for everything to be really done. But it's not that you do everything in a big bang release and everything switches on from one second to the other.
Gotcha. So it means that probably in this case of adding some features touching the users, the front end team has its last word, like now we are ready and we deploy it to the users.
Yeah, it could also be with others, right? If the critical parts are somewhere behind in the backend, this can also be the case. It's also not only feature toggles, right? There's other ways that we have. So we normally call internally our, let's say, markets where we operate. And the so we have Zalando as the fashion store, that's Zalando as you know it. And we also have Zalando Lounge, which is our off-price business. And they are considered also a sales channel. And what we also do, we have like a virtual testing sales channel, which is set up like all the others, but it goes to no real country. And so you can also start deploying stuff there. And also have the possibility to test what you need to test. Yeah. And then it's also not hidden behind a feature toggle, but it's on a, let's say, test sales channel, which is nevertheless on live production systems.
Gotcha. And how the teams do communicate? I mean, do you use some kind of synchronization via change logs of the individual services, or is fully managed by one huge Jira or GitHub enterprise, whatever? Like how it looks like in trenches?
Yeah, also here I would say it's more left to the teams. Of course, there's, as I said, this for example, this principal engineer role who kind of overlooks the whole initiative and makes sure that critical interfaces are well covered and well understood and aligned. However, with so many teams involved, it's always up to the teams, because the teams know their counterparts best, right? So for example, the product of a platform team knows what are their consuming teams, and they align with them on when they can release what. And this works sense, because you do not have to centralize this normally. You need to make sure that it is managed everywhere locally well, but you don't have to centralize it. And that also allows for a really decoupled and fast execution, because you do not have, of course, you have to monitor that, right? It's not like you do not need the central coordination, but the teams themselves can figure it out best, because they know all their consumers and producers and so on. So that the teams or the services where they get the data from, the upstream teams and the downstream teams where they publish to. And so they handle this quite well on an individual basis. And this allows especially for the flexibility to fit it to the needs of the individual teams when they are available to accommodate for this change and so on. And then there's, of course, other mechanisms like versioning of interfaces mm-hmm. or something, which makes it also easier because it's not so hardly coupled, but more flexible.
Yeah. That sounds really, really awesome because it sounds like you are simplifying the things where it's suitable. And for me, it sounds like developing a project on GitHub, open source, whatever, like where you just tracking the other teams working with you. I had very nice conversation with Tim Neutkens of Next.js framework. Mm-hmm. And we were discussing pretty deeply how they cooperate with Facebook team and Google Chrome team on improving the performance of the framework and the browser and the React.js on the stuff. So it's very much similar, like to the way they cooperate. The episode with Tim is to be released next Thursday, I guess. So recommended.
Okay. Cool. I will listen to that.
Yeah, it was really awesome. If I touch the React, so maybe a few words about the front end. I mean, having so many different teams, does it mean that they all use the same front end stack, or is it somehow integrated on higher level? I mean, micro front ends or some other technology?
In general, we have the flexibility for the teams to use what they like, but this does not apply to the whole front end of Zalando as you know it. I'm speaking here of, for example, management, user interfaces that we have for internal stakeholders to steer from a business perspective or something like that. Mm-hmm. The other teams are more free to use it. When it comes to the customer-facing front ends, we have, of course, the need to provide the customers with a consistent experience.
Yeah.
And thus we have something that we call the Zalando design system. That's a kind of interface framework to standardize how we develop front end parts.
Yeah.
And this is kind of set. So you cannot deviate from that. You have mm-hmm. the freedom to work inside of that framework to create new stuff. But you have to use that, of course, because we need to make sure that what the customer finds on the site really makes sense and doesn't break in the experience if they are on a customer journey across the site.
Gotcha. So it makes perfect sense. So it's like kind of design system probably maintained even by different team, right, to make it coherent and mm-hmm. used by all the other teams.
Yeah.
How often you deploy changes to... Like probably depends on from team to team, right? But
exactly
the average, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know the numbers. Tons of times a day, but it's not like you don't have to always deploy everything. I think the key thing is that every time we need to deploy, we can deploy easily because it's of course highly automated. And some teams do like. Immediately deploying with every commit. Some teams don't. So it's also up to them. But the important thing for me is really that whenever we have to, we can do that. And continuous deployment is something that you can do, but you don't have to. But the good thing is we have the tool support and the means for that. So if we need it, then we are able to. And every team can take this decision by themselves.
Gotcha. That's cool. And how the QA process look like? I mean, this is also something that changed from team to team, differs from team to team. But I guess it's very important to keep the service contracts in place. And do you have some automated tests for that? If the service is still compliant or not, or like that would be great to hear how it works.
Yeah. Yeah, this is also very different from team to team. So in general, maybe to start with, what we don't do is we don't have anything like a testing department or testers even.
Okay.
The ones who are testing are the ones who are building the services or the interfaces or whatever. I think this is important also because they also have to run it. So for example, the engineers that build the components also do the 24/7 on-call support if anything goes wrong. And this is great because then they experience firsthand what is going wrong or what are, let's say, problematic parts
they
or aspects.
They feel in charge. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because they feel the pain and they will be running out of bed if something happens in the night.
Yeah.
So they do themselves. It depends. It really is up to the teams. So of course we also try to do something like contract testing. In general, also of course there's automated tests, right? We have of course something like unit tests as the fundamentals, of course, in place. We have some form of automated integration tests. We also have some form of integrated UI tests and so on. But there's also a mixture where we do this sometimes manually. It really depends. I think there's an area where we can also still improve. Also, test data is always a hot topic. Like if we prepare something new end to end, like I said, and things need to be developed until they are behind the feature toggle and could potentially be toggled on. But nevertheless, the teams at the end of this pipeline want to start delivering on that earlier than when all the other teams are done, right?
Yeah.
And so it's always a hot discussion about where do we have test data, who does provide it, do we mock stuff or not? Or even sometimes it comes in very handy what I mentioned, that we have these sales channels that are kind of a parallel universe within our life environment, production environment, that you can use to test things end to end.
Gotcha.
But it's also, it depends.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and probably we can talk about this for hours. I have a few questions more, but we are heading towards the end of our discussion. One of the questions that left on my list is how you set the, let's say, priorities, healthy priorities. I mean, there is always this those contradictional needs of great architecture, clean code, everything maintainable without technical debt, and also the need for short time to market and business features to be deployed. I'm wondering how you set those priorities. You said that they are very transparently presented to all the teams. It's well communicated. Who make the calls, the decisions, and how they are made?
Yeah, I think the topic that you're mentioning here is a constant and unresolved challenge of our profession.
I mean,
talking about microservices, it has become incredibly easy to spin up new services within minutes today, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, all these spun up services need to be maintained in the long run. And that's definitely a challenge. So if you always prioritize business features, your time to market will increase over time and you will get slower and slower. And ultimately, you might be forced into big migrations that might require a lot of your capacity for quite some time. So this is something that you need to avoid, I think, and that you need to constantly balance with the business needs. We've gone also to different approaches. In previous times when we still used OKRs for prioritizing, in one of my departments, we used exactly two objectives. The one was, because it was also mainly driven by external requests and not by ourselves, one was on business features, and the other, and then you can have the key results below. And the other one was on, we called it platform fitness. Mm-hmm. And then you could structure like architectural work below. And this was our approach to balance this in a very transparent way and in a way where we're really forced to think about it. We don't use these OKRs anymore. What we tried now is when we run these initiatives, that we set some predefined time at the end after the business feature is developed to have some time left in order to work on technical debt, clean up activities, and so on.
Yeah.
And it worked sometimes well, sometimes not. I think also it's super important to strive for combining business features with technical work. But for that, you need to have a technical roadmap and the target state, and then you can see what you can combine. And for us, it worked surprisingly often. I would have been more pessimistic before, but nevertheless, what we do now is kind of trying to have a portfolio approach where we from the beginning say we dedicate a certain percentage of our capacity to working on such topics, And we have the rest of the capacity to work on, for example, business features, because it's always a struggle. And, you know, the business features are always urgent and always have the timelines, right? But the timelines of the technical depth that you're building over time is unfortunately not often visible. You just encounter them too late, right? And then you might end up with these big migration projects or whatever you have to do to fix it. And so I think the challenge is really to balancing it on a continuous basis. And this portfolio approach will hopefully be very helpful with that.
That makes perfect sense. And exactly as you said, the business features and time to market, the impact of this time to market to business numbers is pretty easy to measure comparing to the technical depth.
Yeah, like, exactly.
It's very, very difficult to understand the importance of this clean architecture. So I really like this approach where you just leave the space for the teams on the ground, let's say, to make the decision on their own, like this time buffer. Make them in charge, like, guys, do whatever needed to keep it right.
Yeah, it's not totally like that, right? It's not like you may do whatever you wanted to do and think you should. I mean, it is partly, of course, right? Because I think in general, I totally trust the engineers and they know what to do. But what I want to say is that this is guided by, there is a strategic technical target state where we want to get. For example, what I mentioned in the beginning, right? We have these four data storages that are kind of redundant, and we have a clear way how to consolidate them. And there are really work packages of what we need to do as next steps. And we have this as a guidance. And of course, the engineers are still free to also bring in other topics as well. But we also have a clear strategic guidance so that this, as well as the business feature work, it's also to be done in a very efficient and prioritized way. Yep. And we make sure that we do the same there as well.
Gotcha. Makes perfect sense. Okay, so last two questions.
Okay.
What are your plans for the next year, professional plans?
I think an overarching theme that we see and that we want to drive currently is really in this complex setup with so many teams, it became hard to do overarching things, and we want to change that because we have started and already changed it a lot, because if you only in this microservice architecture in a very independent way, what you do is you're optimizing locally, but you are not able to innovate globally. And this is what we want to do, because this makes a difference for our customers. And we started, as I said, a year ago, and I think we've already seen huge improvement in internal collaboration. However, there's still room to improve on that. And we will continue working on this, also in this cross-functional collaboration and so on, and making sure that various teams can work well together. And secondly, also in this prioritization, it's important to not focus on too many topics at the same time, but to ensure the focus. Yeah. And there's also something where we can still improve. And we are on our way, I would say. And we're learning and trying to keep improving.
Awesome. Sounds pretty good. Challenging, but also ambitious. So good. Good goals are always like this. So the last question: which technical trends makes you excited?
If I may, I would put up. I'm not sure I can bring very cool examples here of technical trends. I mean, there's lots of things, right? We are making a lot of progress with machine learn supported stuff and so on and so forth. This is really cool to see. But I think this is not new, and everybody knows that. If I may pick up some other trends, I would like to pick one business one and two, let's say, leadership or however ones. So the business one is what I've also illustrated with this pre-owned fashion that we have is the sustainability trend, which is an important topic. Yep. I mean, in this pandemic, we have seen a huge shift towards e-commerce, right? And there's also discussions, especially now during Christmas time, about what this means on the logistics side and whether this is sustainable and so on and so forth. And we really try to make this better. First of all, for example, through this pre-owned fashion, where you can give your close that you left, but you do not like that much anymore, a second life, so to say, which is quite good, and also caters to other people's needs not to buy the newest clothes.
Yeah.
And we also work on, for example, topics like sizing, right? It's the challenge in e-commerce, especially in fashion, to figure out what is it that fits yourself. And we're doing a lot of stuff there. And I'm really excited about that because I think this can really help making this whole industry more sustainable and better for all of our future, especially as it's shifting so much towards e-commerce. And secondly,
that's pretty
and
exciting.
Indeed.
Really cool.
And secondly, and this is also connected to the pandemic. It's really a tragedy if you look at it as a whole, but it also had some positive aspects that we saw. And one was, Zalando's teams are also spread across multiple locations. So we have, for example, an engineering hub in Dublin. We have one in Helsinki. And I've always been part of an organization which was spread across Berlin and Dublin. And I'm based out of Berlin, by the way. And in the past, we also collaborated and it was not particularly bad, but it also was not particularly great. And what happened during the pandemic is, that because we were short of capacity, three colleagues from a neighboring department in Dublin supported one of my departments in Berlin. And the funny thing is, in the face of the pandemic, it worked smooth. It was like a breeze. It was super cool because everyone had equal opportunities. Everyone was remote. No one was at a disadvantage because he could not be in the office or she. And it was super impressive to see how easily this worked and how.
Do you think this is gonna stay with us or gonna be back to let's say previous state after the COVID?
I'm pretty sure we will not go back to the previous state. I also don't think that it will stay like that 100%, right? Because there is value in human interaction. And I personally can say, I'm in a home office since March, which is quite a time. And sometimes I have to admit I miss talking to other people, not only on a screen, other people than my family. I love them, but also talking to others, not only on the screen would be nice. And I think there's value in that. And also this is another example that I wanted to bring up. This category experience department that I mentioned, this is a newly founded department and we built it from scratch, so from zero during the pandemic. So many of the people were hired and onboarded without us having seen them in person ever. And this worked as well. And I'm super impressed by that. And this makes me really excited. Nevertheless, I think we also need to be very careful as leaders there because it demands a lot of the people and it is challenging. And I would say on a physical as well as on a psychological side. Yeah. But nevertheless, I'm super excited. So if you're asking what I think will happen after the pandemic, I think we will need to come to a kind of hybrid model at least, where this is much more normal. And at the same time, I think this will also change the work from the office, right? So if people are in the office, I think we cannot assume that everyone will be. So doing video conferences will have to become a kind of standard because otherwise people not there would be at disadvantage, which I think we cannot afford. And it will change the ways we work also in from the offices. And I'm excited about that nevertheless. It has a lot of downsides as well. And we have to learn to deal with them. But in the end, I think it allows for much better flexibility to cater to people's needs and their personal life and circumstances. So I think that's a good development nevertheless.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. And by the way, my personal feelings and observations are pretty much the same. So I believe that we're going to be able to use the best things from those two ways of working. I think that, as you said, that the core will stay remotely. I can't imagine a situation where you being remote, engineer, developer, PM, whatever, you are just missing things because you are not at the office. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I can also imagine that some like weekly, bi-weekly meetings are held at the office to just keep everything motivated, because from my experience, this is the weakest part of this new, let's say, new economy or way we work, that you simply got demotivated. It's very easy to get demotivated if you are sitting on your own in front of a computer. Okay, you can use Slack to chat with people, but you are not chatting that much because it's not that natural, like chatting by the cup of coffee at the office. So it breaks those, you know, people connections a lot.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I mean, I also think we will figure out more ways to do this more effectively.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it becomes also much harder for us to detect when something goes wrong with some people who struggle with that. And I think this will definitely also remain a challenge.
Yeah. That's a good point. Absolutely. Yeah. Because on these, you know, remote tools like Slack, Hangouts, whatever, is getting more and more transactional. Mm-hmm. You're just contacting somebody because you need something. And if not, you're just not contacting anymore.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, maybe a last thing. Yesterday we had in one of the departments, we had a Christmas celebration event. Yeah. And that was really nice because it was facilitated. First of all, we did a kind of exit game that was done online. And then we had some getting together personally because it was the overall theme of the thing was food. And then we had some prepared questions that everyone answered to introduce themselves to the others, like what's the food of your childhood and so on. And then we cooked together, but remote. And it was also,
awesome.
it was going surprisingly. I mean, it's not very, I mean, it's some of the standard things that are kind of common today in this situation. But it worked surprisingly well. And nevertheless, people connected quite well. And we had a lot of fun. And I think we will just learn to do these things better and get to that. And nevertheless, I'm happy when next year we can do a Christmas party in person.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something I think we all are waiting for, like having those winter parties, other parties as well. Okay, thank you, Jan. It was great having you. Thank you for preparing to this conversation and your time. It was awesome.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thanks a lot. I also enjoyed the conversation. And take care. Stay healthy.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the CTO to CTO podcast. Make sure you hit subscribe and also check out our new YouTube channel where we've prepared some surprises for you. See you next week.